Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I have on the line with me
Terry DeCastro.
Welcome, Terry, to the Raucous Caucus.
Yes.
And speaking of you, I want to talk today about mental illness.
Thank you, my favorite subject. No, I'm so well qualified.
Well, I actually think you're pretty good at it. I mean, knowledge of mental illness is what. Of course, I'm referring to.
It's not a dosage problem.
I don't know if it's a dosage problem, but that's between you and your doctor.
Okay.
No, I want to talk about mental illness because it is obviously a serious subject, particularly when I heard news that there were shots ringing out near the Capitol. Couple days ago, for those of us in Washington, D.C., this kind of stuff is getting sickeningly familiar. It was just 3 or 4 weeks ago, maybe even not that long ago, that in the Naval Yard, which, by the way, I drive past on my way to We Act Radio. I literally go around the perimeter of the Naval Yard. And so, you know, for those of you who have been living in a cave, of course, you know that you don't know then that there was a military contractor who had a history of mental illness, a history of, shall we say, anger management problems, things like shooting at the tires of a car, I forget, people who disagree with him.
That's an Olympic sport in Texas, isn't it?
You know, maybe it is. But clearly had a history of anger and management problems, and yet still, despite the fact that, this guy is problematic and hearing voices and so forth, he's approved by a military contractor to work in a very secure location in D.C. First thing I said when I heard there were shots there, I said it must be an inside job because you can't get into that place.
Not easily.
No, not at all. I mean, even if you try to barge your way in, you'd be shot because they've got, you know, they're guarding the doors. And of course, he killed a dozen people. I mean, it's
13,
amazing.
I think.
And after Newtown, and after, I mean, just all you have to do is say the places, right? Tucson, Aurora, Colorado. I mean, Aurora and Newtown. I didn't know these places existed. I mean, you know, you just say the names. Littleton, Connecticut. Colorado. Excuse me. That's
well. No matter where it happens, it becomes closer and closer to you. I mean, you know, we had the shooting here in Clackamas Mall. Which is only, 10 miles from where I am.
And the Naval Yard is probably 2 miles from where I am. Mm-hmm. Not even, probably 1 mile, just across the Anacostia River. And so it's coming closer and closer. And there's actually two elements that combine in all of these cases. One is, of course, guns, and we've talked a lot about that, and we will continue to. And the other, though, is mental illness. I mean, these are not terrorist attacks. We have to be wary of those too. But actually, terrorist attacks in America, with the exception of September 11th, kill far less than mentally ill people do with guns. And I look at this woman who just 2 days ago, so now we know what happened. She apparently drove her car in. She told her husband that she was hearing voices and that the president was spying on her thoughts. And she went off with her 8-month-year-old infant in the back of the car from Connecticut, drove to the White House, and tried to drive onto that street where it's now a pedestrian street. Used to be you could drive through that street.
And all the barriers are there.
But since, I guess, September 11th or so, the barriers are there. And it's a walking street. It's actually a very pleasant thing. I go there. I show people the White House all the time. You can actually remove those barriers in an emergency, but she obviously just drove in, tried to get past those barriers, couldn't do it. And the Secret Service, the cops surrounded her car. And they pointed like 5 guns at her and told her to stop. And she didn't stop. There was a Secret Service agent on top of her car. He rolled off the car. She hit another police car, injured a guy inside, and then managed to speed off to a high-speed chase right down Pennsylvania Avenue, right down the heart of Washington, D.C., the road that connects the White House and the Capitol, the important road of our democracy, right, connecting all our branches of government, and is shot dead outside.
There's a connection?
Outside the Capitol. Well, right now, there's only a road that connects them. There's no actual...
There's a lot of potholes. There's hundreds of speed bumps.
And I would just say thousands of brick walls, but
yeah.
That's another issue, which we could talk about in a bit. In any case, the point is, this woman is dead, and I understand why. I actually do. I fully respect, you know, you try to ram the White House or the Capitol, you're going to get shot dead. I get it. And she could have been a terrorist and she could have had a bomb in her car. And so I've heard some people attack the police. You know, we can look at some video, but that's not my issue here. My issue is here is she'd be alive today and no police officer would be injured and 13 people in the Naval Yard would be living if we had better treatment for mental illness. Now, that doesn't in any way excuse that we don't have background checks on guns. And that's another issue that we've talked at length and we can continue to talk about. But it seems to me that, and hopefully Obamacare will change this, we simply do not have treatment for a huge amount of mental illness in this country.
It goes back to, and I'm sure you're aware of this, Mark, and it goes back to the 70s and 80s when there were a lot of atrocities that happened within mental health homes, within asylums, as it were. And, you know, it became a media frenzy and in some ways very legitimate. Excuse me. But it became such a big issue that there was these atrocities going on in mental health things. They began to work towards the outpatient idea, which absolutely is probably the stupidest idea that's ever been developed by any society in the world. You have a mental, you have a patient with mental illness that needs some kind of help, that needs some kind of care. It's recognized by family. It's recognized by associates. And it's horrible if you just lock them up in a prison-like environment and just give them, you know, crayons to chew on. That's horrible. But we went from that extreme to saying, okay, we'll give them medication, we'll give them treatment, and then we'll let them be outpatients. And they'll come back on a regular basis to get their treatment because now that they've got six pills a week, they're okay. I mean, it's absurd. And this is what led to the incredible level of homelessness in this country. There's always been poverty, but the homelessness in the cities, particularly cities like New York and Washington, Chicago, all the big cities, people who were mentally ill, who were literally cast out of their institutions, which did provide some protection, some care, and now we rely upon them to show up once a month or whatever the sequence is to get their medication. It's insane in itself. It's not the patient that's insane. What's insane is our treatment.
And what we have is some 70 to 80% of the homeless today are mentally ill. Some is substance abuse, which in itself is a form of mental illness. But a lot of it is simply people. Listen, in every society, in every human race, religion, ethnicity, you're going to have 1, 2, 3% of people that are mentally ill. It happens. It happens like physical illness. It is natural. It is genetic. You're always going to have it. That go back into history. There's always been mental illness. And the question is, what do you do about it? And the answer is, if you ignore the problem, it just doesn't go away.
No.
It's not like you can say, these people, they're mentally ill. If we just ignore them, they'll go on the streets and they'll die, I guess, if you're completely cruel. Today, particularly with the easy access of guns, it's not, look, there are people that have very little compassion for the mentally ill. I have compassion for this woman. I mean, she heard voices. She thought Obama was in her mind. With some manner of maybe there's lots of medication today. There's schizophrenic medication. There's bipolar medication. There's a lot of medication today to treat things like this. And had she gotten her meds, she would most likely be alive today. And in the case of the Naval Yard, if he had gotten his meds, then most likely not only would he be alive, but 13 others too. I mean, the Aurora, Colorado killer thought he was in a movie. He thought he was in the Batman movie. And what, 70 people? They shot 70 rounds or something? A couple dozen people are dead. I mean, this is crazy. We go to war for lesser crimes than happened in Aurora, Colorado. And this guy, frankly, didn't even mean to do it. I don't even know how I can blame him. I mean, I think it's horrible, obviously, what he did. Well, I can imagine crouching in a movie theater and some crazy man shooting at me. But he is literally not in his right mind.
There's something perverse in our society, and I don't know exactly what it is, and I'm sure it's not just only Americans, but we do look down on the mentally ill. It's a way of exalting ourselves to, like any other thing, I rip you to shreds as a human being, politically or in terms of commentary, which I would, of course, never do to you, Mark.
I appreciate that.
If I did that. You know, what I'm doing primarily is trying to aggrandize myself.
Right. I understand.
And somehow or other, with the mentally ill, who are the most vulnerable of all people, the most vulnerable, we look down on them so that we can feel really good about ourselves. And therefore, that allows us not to do anything compassionate to help them.
And in not doing so, we don't only harm them, we harm us as well. Is it Garland join us? Is that who's on the line?
And I find it rather alarming that the first words I heard out of Perry's mouth was about ripping another human being to pieces.
No, yeah, well, we were doing that to you, but then you called in. We had to stop.
Yeah, we stopped. We stopped. Yeah, we're back on track. But I lived in Manhattan during the crack epidemic, and I mean the homeless were just everywhere. It was horrible. It was frightening. It was disgusting. It was tragic, and there was practically nothing done to help these people. And yes, you can say it's crack fault, and they're addicted and all that. No, most of them were people that had mental problems beforehand. They seek some kind of escape from their mental turmoil, and crack seemed to work,
Well, go ahead, Garland. You are now joining us late, but you know what? I've been on late on shows before, too, so I guess I'll forgive you.
I don't think so. I think it's just Garland.
Pretty much. How are you, Garland, sir?
I am just wonderful, gentlemen. And we're talking about the mentally ill, I take it?
We are. We're talking about mental illness and how they are taken care of, or shall we say not taken care of in America.
Lord.
And the consequences for it. I talked about the woman who in Washington, D.C., who was just shot dead, but also the guy at the Naval Yard, the guy in Aurora, Colorado, the guy in Tucson that shot Gabby Giffords. This happens in every culture, every place. And again, I certainly do want gun control. We've done lots of shows on that. We absolutely have to have background checks for the mentally ill, but also for the mentally ill themselves. I mean, this woman, presumably, if she'd gotten medication, would not have had to die, and a police officer would not have had to be injured a few days ago.
It's just like so many other things in our society. We turn our back on those in need, but you can turn your back all you want. At some point, they're going to come back. These things come back to haunt you. And so, as a society, we overlook people in need. We don't care for the mentally ill. We don't help out we don't do anything about the gun crisis in the inner city. But these things come back, just like these last couple of incidents here in
Washington.
To haunt us. And if nothing else, for our own self-preservation,
right.
For our own selfishness, if we can't motivate ourselves as a society for anything else, but for our own safety, we need
right. She could have run down so many pedestrians. When I think about that mad chase and down the heart of Pennsylvania Avenue at high speeds, breaking lights, and I think of all the tourists in Washington, D.C., she very easily could have run over some children, a whole bunch of people. It's tragic that she got shot, but thank God it was only her and not running over and killing 30, 40 more people. And I guess my question for you gentlemen is, do you think that with the Affordable Care Act coming into play this January in a place near you, go to healthcare.gov to sign up, do you think this will help? Because my understanding is mental illness is fully covered. And, of course, I haven't looked at all the plans yet. But shouldn't this make things better? Who wants to start?
It should. It should. But the real problem, again, goes back to our attitude, and maybe perhaps the passage of the Health Care Act shows that our attitude is changing a little bit, although I doubt it because there's now so much violence connected with the insanity. But we still don't really provide well for the truly mentally ill, because if you think about it, you cannot imagine a more difficult job for a medical person, a nurse or a nurse's aide or whatever, to work in a mental institution with mentally ill people.
You
cannot imagine.
Oh, my God, the patience they must have.
Yeah, and we pay them nothing.
Yeah.
We the people that we need the most, teachers, nurses, et cetera, the people
caregivers
that really are out there caring for those who need care, are the people that we pay the least. And that in and of itself is creating the problem.
And of course, there's the class issue as well, because the rich can send, there was always where, the crazy royalty, right? The mad kings and so forth, they could go to the best insane asylums in the world and get, Mad King Lugwood, I'm sure, did just fine. But when you're poor or middle class and you're mentally ill, you're far more likely to take it out on your family and or the people around you. And, you know, the care may not even cost that much. It may just be taking lithium or taking a few drugs.
Well, you know, and this is another example, I mean, to get back to the ACA and dealing with mentally ill. You know, those who are opposed said, well, you can go to a... you can just go to an emergency room. Well, you know what? You can't go to an emergency room for depression. You can't go to a emergency room for schizophrenia. A very close family member of mine runs the, at one of the major hospitals in the area, runs security. And I never thought about it, but he said they have a ward, you know, the psych ward where they have people who come in and say, I need to be in. Well, I know of an instance where a person didn't want to leave, and they said, well, we can't keep you anymore. And he said, I don't want to leave. You know, I might do something. You know, I don't know what I'll do. Well, they told him he had to leave, basically ran him out of the hospital. A couple of days later, he beat a man to death with a baseball bat. But he didn't want to leave. So, you know, I'm just hoping that, you know, I don't know. You know, I think all of us kind of really need to dig into the Affordable Care Act a little bit more. I know I do. We need to really understand how these various things are addressed, but I feel better, but it makes me feel even angrier at those who are fighting right now to oppose health care coverage for people in need.
I also want to say something about that Terry brought up in the first part about the stigma of mental illness, and I want to tell my own personal story here. I had a, I don't know, I guess I could call him a good acquaintance. It wasn't a real close friend, but definitely a friend in law school. I guess I won't give his name, although it wouldn't really matter because it's been made public. But this was a guy at Yale Law School, and he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He in the classes, he would break all kinds of very interesting comments. He was a good liberal. He was someone who was very aware of the social issues of the day and really had a great mind to how to work things. Professors, Yale Law School professors, used him, not me, used him, to help them with their writings and so forth. So brilliant guy and a very caring guy. And he had a very close relationship with his girlfriend. They'd been together. He's a bit older than the rest of us. They'd been together, I think, 10 years or something at that time. They were going to get married. And, he wore very, very thick glasses. And, you know, you don't really think that much about that. Some people have bad eyes. But, as I got to know him better, he confided in me that the medicine he was taking was making him blind. And I said to him, why are you taking medicine that's making you blind? And he said, because he's a schizophrenic. And I really had never met, before Beautiful Mind, I hadn't seen, I asked him, you know, what is that, you know, what's that like? I kind of knew vaguely what it was. And he said to me, and I really thought it was fascinating how he described it. He said, let me tell you what goes on in my mind. He said, right now, Mark, think like you go to the Best Buy and you see 20 TVs on different channels. He said, I've got 10 or 12 realities going on in my mind at the exact same time. One of which I'm talking to you. That's one screen, okay? In another screen, I am in a concentration camp being beat by Nazis. In another screen, some guy's running after me with a knife. In another screen, someone is killing my girlfriend. In another screen, I'm in the war zone getting shot at. And the only reason, Mark, that I believe that talking to you is what's actually going on is because the other screens are so violent and so scary and so awful that I choose to believe that this is the proper reality. And I've been convinced and people have persuaded me that this is what's actually going on. And these other realities that are going in my mind right now, I'm only ignoring because I'm rationally filtering them and saying that can't logically be happening. I can't really be on fire right now. I must be talking to Mark Levine.
And because he's got the medication that is allowing him even to go that
and far. to separate his talk with me from everything else. And I thought, what a horrific thing. I don't even understand. I mean, I'm not schizophrenic. I don't understand how you undergo two or three realities at once. Vaguely, maybe I can think of when you're in a dream state, you know, and you wake up from a dream and that's sort of still going on, but you're in your bed. So I have, you know, some tiny, tiny understanding. Unfortunately, the story does not have a happy ending, my friends. A few years after law school, they found my friend wandering all disheveled in Central Park. His girlfriend was murdered with a knife, and he did it. Apparently, it's still not clear why, he couldn't get a refill of his medication. I don't really know what happened. Maybe he thought he could go off it for a few days. Maybe he didn't like the fact the medication was making him blind, although it did allow him to control his mind. For whatever the case, he killed the thing he loved most in the world. which was this woman who was truly a wonderful woman that he truly loved. I mean, this was a good, this is a good person. This is a good human being. He really, he, and that's the thing, I guess, that struck me. I never really knew anyone like that before. He's a good person, but he went off his medication for whatever reason. And there was a question whether it was going to be a murder trial. There wasn't. He was found, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity, and he's locked up for everyone's safety, as he should be, in a mental place where I've actually talked to him since then. And he, of course, is devastated by what he's done and can't forgive himself. And but my point is, ordinary, kind, brilliant people can in fact, a lot of schizophrenics turn out to be brilliant. I mean, a beautiful mind, right? I mean, they turn out to be...
A lot of mentally ill people are brilliantly. It's a very fine line between sanity. I mean, we always think that we are sane, but it's a very fine line between sanity and insanity and intelligence. It's all very fine. We can all tell, you know, classic stories. I had a good friend, have a good friend, whose daughter recently committed suicide. And she was in college. She was a successful student and everything else, and she committed suicide. And I was in a discussion about suicide, and he was in the room as well in the discussion. And he finally got a little irritated, and he said, "My daughter didn't die of suicide. My daughter died of depression."
Mm-hmm.
And right. I really believe that is one of the most brilliant observations. You know, because again, with the suicide thing, we sort of look at it in a black way. We say, well, how could they do it? And they're thoughtless and, you know, what a mean, horrible thing to do to their family. And well, obviously they were nuts. Without understanding, they don't die of suicide. They die of depression. And we don't sympathize with that. We don't recognize the real problem. And we keep on turning our back on these things that are so obvious. I mean, back for centuries, you know, it was just where you had demons. And, you know, therefore, because you had demons, you know, you were spat upon and you were just cast out on the society. Then this guy named Jesus shows up and he says, no, well, whatever they are, we're getting rid of it. They're not bad people. Well, we even ignore that philosophy, you know. We still just lock them up, ignore them, spit on them. And I see it also, the other place that disturbed me the most, or one of the, is being an substitute teacher, or an absolute, but a substitute teacher in the Alexandria school system for a number of years, and a number of times I would teach in special ed classes. And yes, the special ed teachers try to do a good job, and their assistants try to do a good job, but the students treat the kids. This is a bully society we live in.
Right.
And they, I don't care what this is about, no bully policy or anything else, they bully the kid who is unstable. It's absolutely horrible.
It's true. I don't know, Garland, if you've got your own sort of story.
No, yeah, actually I do, believe it or not. I mean, I often joke about it, but I've got ADD, attention deficit disorder, and I take Wellbutrin for it. So, you know, I know if I were unable, I mean, I, you know, wouldn't freak out or anything, but my life is better because of it. I can't focus if I don't take, you know, if I don't take Wellbutrin, I'll start losing everything. You know, my things will get all messy around me. You know, the paperwork and administrative things that I need to do in my life, bills and things start getting all kind of tangled and mangled up. And with the Wellbutrin, I'm able to focus and have a better life. So I actually, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, a learning disability, whatever you would call it, attention deficit disorder, but I have a pretty powerful case of it. And without it, you know, my life is different. But because I have healthcare coverage, you know, I can get what I need and my life is better. And so there are people who even, you know, have various disabilities, various learning disorders, and things like that, who take medications where their life may not be in danger, but they have a better quality of life. So, I really want to find out what the coverage is. I think it's important to find out what the coverage is on the Affordable Care Act. So it's something that we can, you know, discuss the strengths and weaknesses of it in the event that we're challenged by someone, a caller or anyone.
I'll tell you, I've been trying to get in. I have gotten in occasionally. Virginia is one of, I think, 34 states that didn't set up their own plan and is using the federal plan.
I think it's 26.
Is it 26? Okay. All right. So it's about half. And, you know, we have time because this doesn't even go into effect until January. So, you know, it's not like I can wait another couple weeks to look at it. I understand. I mean, this thing is too popular. That's its problem. You know, millions and millions, something like 5 million people went the very first day to the website. That makes a website crash.
The last I heard in a red state, Kentucky, 11,000, the first couple of days, 11,000 people had signed up.
Yeah. And that's with the down. the fact that the website's often down because so many people are trying. I know Maryland has its own plan, which is where you are, Garland. How about you, Terry? Does Oregon have its own plan?
Oregon has a superb plan. Oregon's, in fact, is sort of the model for other states on how to get into the Health Care Act. And it's got a really well-organized structure around it, advertising around it, facilities to people to help people, et cetera. So it's very good. At the same time, no state that I know of really provides decent care for the mentally ill. And, you know, Garland, you mentioned attention deficit disorder, and I know this would come as a shock to you, but I also have it, plus a few other problems. And, you know,
I've been accused of it. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I don't take any medication for it. But, hey, well, on Raucous Caucus, we move around topics so fast that I think maybe all three of us do it.
Could be. But, I mean, what the point is, see, that is also, and this some people may not understand, but that is also part of our energy and our creativity. I know that working in theater, it was my ability and is my ability to be able to focus on things at an incredibly rapid rate, to see how a light cue isn't quite right, how an actor's gesture isn't quite right, to see all of these things simultaneously. It is part of what is, I consider, my talent, certainly part of my profession. At the same time, like anything else, it's a curse and a blessing. I can get caught
right
into a attention deficit, you know, swirl and really not know where the heck my mind is going. At other times,
right,
I can be incredibly focused with it and use it as a very creative thing. So we're not,
a lot of
these lines are very fine.
And they're not, and the point is it's not all bad. That's exactly what we're trying to say, is that you can be, you know, no one is perfect. Everyone, all of us human beings are flawed in some way or another. You know, for some, it's their personality. For some, it's, you know, maybe their looks. For some, it's they might have diabetes, or they might have attention deficit disorder, or they might have, you know, one leg shorter than the other, whatever it is. You know, none of us are perfect, and but yet all of us give what we can. And this idea of saying that one genetic abnormality is somehow less than another one is just it's crazy talk. I mean, to me, I think of the Nazis and eugenics, and one of the first people that they killed were the mentally ill because they said, you know, they have no value. And that's crazy. You just pointed out how what might be construed as a mental illness, Terry, helps you in the theater. So, go ahead, Gon.
And the other thing about that, very quickly, what a lot of people don't know about attention deficit disorder is they can also be the opposite. If a person with ADD, something that they really like or they're really interested in, they get what's called hyperfocus, tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. And they can be more focused. If it's something they're really interested in, they can be more focused than they just forget about everything else in the world and get this insane hyperfocus on one thing, which can be positive if you're learning about something you're interested in. But what I was going to say was this. The difference, I think, between, you know, the progressives, the left and the right is this. We see our society like one big unit, you know, like your car. If you have a car, if the muffler is bad, then the whole car has a problem. If the one wheel bearing is bad, or if, you know, the steering wheel, you know, is making noise or whatever, the whole car doesn't work right. Well, if you have a society and the mentally ill don't get their the care they need, it's going to affect the whole society in one way or another. If some people get something and others don't, the inequality, we are not 300 million individuals. We are a unit. We are a group of people that work together, whether we choose to admit it or not.
Yeah.
And the irony there, too, is we call ourselves, for the most part, a Christian nation, and that is at the heart of the Christian theology,
absolutely,
philosophy, doctrine. I mean, it's
absolutely
the letters of Paul, et cetera, that simply point out that every single, you know, the analogy he uses is the body, and basically pointing out that the foot is as important as the brain, you know, and just goes through all of the parts of the body that serve their purpose, that are necessary for society, that we need each other. That is the single most clear point in Christianity, that there are no separate, not connected people. We are all interconnected. Yet, as a Christian nation, we're real hard-ass about it.
Yeah, we're an individualist nation. I was just going to add that in Judaism, everything is for the community. Everything is done. You know, we are our brother's keeper. I mean, it's one of the very first words in the Bible. And the idea is that if anything goes wrong in the community, all of us are actually at fault. On Yom Kippur, which I just went to services for Yom Kippur a few weeks ago, and we read out these long lists of sins, turning your head and ignoring the plight, not hearing someone's cries, things that that we've done wrong. And the rabbi says, you know, you may not have personally done every one of these things, but someone in the community has. And to the extent that someone in the community is not looking out for someone else, that's your burden too. If someone is not feeding the hungry, maybe you fed the hungry, but someone else in your community is not. We are responsible for everyone. And that's why you never say, and it's in the Jewish religion, you never say, I have sinned. You say, we have sinned. Because the sin is a sin of the community. We're going to take a break and get back to this discussion of mental illness, and also take your calls at 202-889-9797. We'll be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I am here with
Garland Nixon.
I love doing that. See, I first, sometimes you both say it at once. This time you both waited for the other one. With Garland Nixon and Terry D. Kester. Welcome, welcome. We're talking about mental illness and trying to cause a little amongst ourselves, and trying to, frankly, figure out why we don't have the compassion to deal with the huge problem of mental illness. You know, I mean, other countries have it. I mean, they're crazy people, and maybe I shouldn't even use that word. I probably shouldn't.
No.
I think maybe we should go to another
mentally unbalanced. I mean, there are people who are dangerous to themselves and to others. And the irony is that if we don't show enough compassion to care about them, then they sometimes will harm others, and that's what we've seen a lot recently.
I'll give you some real facts here, because I just checked this out.
Sure.
From the National Institute of Health.
Okay.
An estimated 26.2% of Americans ages 18 and older, about 1 in 4 adults, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder in any given year.
22%. Wow.
26%.
26%.
When applied to the U.S., in 2004, that means that there were 57.7 million people in this country alone that have some kind of mental disorder. About 6%, 1 in 17, suffer from a serious mental illness.
6%.
And that's what we're dealing with here. This is not one or two people that
right.
we happen to see witnessing in Washington, D.C. in the last couple of tragedies.
Right.
This is a huge part of our population, and either we love and care for these people, or we're just going to try to cast them aside, and that's not going to work.
Gentlemen, we have a caller on the line. Michael from New York wants to say his 2 cents. Michael, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Thank you, gentlemen. You know, I take into account of what has gone on during the recent weeks, if you want to go even recent years, or months or years. You know, when it comes to the mentally ill, it seems to me that a lot of this is caused by Republicans and bullies that just want to abuse the mentally deficient, thinking that they're incapable of standing up, you know, for their own rights, and just want to keep, you know, abusing the mentally ill and inconveniencing them. That's the word I'm looking for. You know, you rob them of their rights. You rob them of their dignity. You even just cheat them out of funds or treatment or do all these substantial cuts. And to me, it's just that the Republicans just don't give a doggone. And then when push comes to shove, when heaven forbid, like what happened with this poor woman from Stamford, Connecticut, Miriam,
Carrie was her last name.
Carrie? Mm-hmm. Carrie, yes. I would not hesitate to say that this government shutdown could have been the last straw that might have made her tick, and she was already had issues of mental problems.
You know, I don't know, but I'll tell you something that you raise a good point on, Michael, and that is that when it comes to the weak in our society And you can be weak because you're a child, and we've had children who are terribly abused because they couldn't speak out because they were children and parents who treat them like property. When it comes to the poor in America who are busy trying, struggling to save lives. And yes, the mentally ill often cannot stand up for themselves. If you are severely mentally challenged, you're not going to be able to call your member of Congress and demand your rights like, you know, informed citizens should do. It's very easy to pick on the mentally ill unless they've got good, caring family members who are willing to advocate for them. They are some of the people least able to defend their rights in a democratic society. I think it's a solid point. Garland, did you want to say something? Well, go ahead, Michael. You have something more to say? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But guess what? It's not just the mentally ill either, because when you have traumatic events in your life, 9/11, the Sandy Hook shootings, you know, even those that are mostly mentally stable, these are situations that could have been prevented, but it's still stuck in the minds of, you know, some people. It's a traumatic experience.
Right, and I was going to say, we have a lot of veterans that have post-traumatic stress syndrome themselves and are a danger to themselves and others because we put something, you probably know these statistics better than I do, Terry, or maybe you, Garland. So, something like a third or something? I mean, war is such hell. People are trying to kill you, and you have to kill others or be killed. It's such hell that I've never been in war, and I can't imagine, frankly. I can imagine it, but I guess I can't really go there. I forget the statistics. Something like a third or 40%, some huge number, come away. People who weren't mentally, ill before come away with a severe shell shock, they used to call it, in World War One.
Every one of us is vulnerable in many areas, whether we want to admit it or not. And if we put, be it society or be it economic stress, if we put tons and tons of stress and anxiety on every individual, we are going to have all kinds of mental health chaos. It's not something that happens just because they have a genetic defect. It's also the society we live in. Just as a comparison, I pointed out to you that we have 26% of Americans at any given time from the age of 18 on are suffering from some kind of mental disorder. At the same time, as you probably know, we have, in the ratio of guns per capita, 94 guns for every 100 people.
Wow.
We are just buried in.
Someone's carrying my gun because I don't have mine. I've never owned a gun. But
well, there's a whole lot of people that got 35 guns.
Well, I know. That's what makes it all average out.
Everywhere, and yet we live in a society which doesn't even deal with mental illness, let alone guns.
It's a problem.
Talk about an insanity. I mean, our policies are what are insane, not the people.
It's true.
People are ill. Our policies are irrational.
Can I raise one more point?
Sure. Go ahead.
You know, when it comes to this furlough, all right, my wife is a federal employee, and she's currently furloughed. She said she's been through this before, but right now it's me that is being stressed. I'm trying to keep it together.
Right, I'm sure.
So, you know, especially these Republicans, they don't realize that you're not just hurting some people directly. You're also hurting their loved ones, which is indirectly. I just find it reprehensible that this party, or anybody for that matter, would just mess with people's lives, people's emotions, people's livelihoods, and not give a hoot except for trying to profit out of it.
Well, I would argue that's part of what makes them Republicans, Michael. That's part of what makes them members of the Tea Party. It's this individualism we talked about, the community that's in communities of faith and communities of this country. And I would argue it's this sheer individualism. You know, I got mine, Jack, you get yours. And then what happens when you have a problem? Well, no one's there to help you. Thank you, Michael, for your call. Yeah. Thanks for joining in. Garland, you haven't said anything in a while. I know you've got your 2 cents. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I was just listening to everyone, and one thing I hear, the discussion about the things in our society that cause anxiety. You know, the people in our society, number one, there's a very high ambient level of anxiety, and if you look at what's going on in the government, that has to do with it. If you look at the inequality, that has to do with it. That these things affect it. So we have people that are dealing with mental illness. We have a lot that are dealing with a lot of stress. Because, you know, most people in our society are barely getting along or barely making it.
That's true.
Being a tiny, very few people who have a lot. And I think that number one, the people with mentally ill, when you tackle in the stress, sometimes that pushes them over the edge. And people that aren't, per se, clinically mentally ill, many of them are so stressed out that they get pushed over the edge.
You know, everyone is on edge today. I think sometimes we look down on what we might call primitive or pre-industrial societies where, you know, there's no TV and there's no internet and the people sit out in the farmland or the forest or wherever and swap stories around a fire or whatever it is. And we think, you know, well, they don't know what Starbucks coffee is, you know, but they in many ways are much happier. And the reason they're happy is not because they're wealthy, obviously, and not because they have their gadgets and toys that we have. But what they do have, the one thing they absolutely have is community, and they look out for each other. And if someone is a little bit off, they look out for them even more because that person needs a little more help. And again, I think about what Michael says about Republicans don't care about anyone else. You know, I like to think that if we would think there, but for the grace of God, go I. You never know. Mental illness sometimes can come later in life. Or it can go away. You can be born, you know, same thing with physical illness, right? I mean, you can be born perfectly healthy and then you get cancer and then you can beat that cancer. So the same is true with mental illness, and some of it can be treated by drugs. But it's all about recognizing that the way I see it, you know, I guess I'll throw it to you. You threw in Christian stuff, Terry. I'll throw in Jewish philosophy. The great, Rabbi Hillel said, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? And to me, that means that, you know, anyone out there, it could be me. It could be me. And I would want care. And I would want to do to others what I would want done to me. Golden rule, basic morality. And just seems to me the opposite is the Ayn Rand, I got mine, Jack school of I'm doing fine, leave me alone. And then, like I said, when you get sick, I mean, I just think of all the moral plays. What is it? Who is it that build makes the bread and no one will help them? And then the bread's ready and they all want to eat. I don't know. I'm thinking of all Aesop's fables. The heart of what I'm trying to say is that if you don't look out for others, then how can you expect anyone to look out for you?
Years back, I know, Garland, did you want to jump in?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, years back, I know this is going to hurt you guys, and I apologize for it, but years back, I went through a spell when I was much more conservative than I am now.
Were you living in Texas at the time?
No, I did live in Texas, and that did not leave me the conservative.
All right, okay.
The hell out of me, let me tell you.
All right.
You know, but anyway.
Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, I was more conservative, and it was, you know, more sort of supporting a libertarian sort of view and a Ross Perot point of view. And I was working at Wolf Trap. And I got in a big argument with my boss, who I have the greatest respect for, and Ralph Hoffman. I use his name because he's a great guy. And recently passed, not recently, but a few years passed back, he's sort of the guy that held Wolf Trap together. Anyway, we're working at Wolf Trap, and we got in an argument. And he finally turned to me and he said, look, Terry, the first responsibility of government is compassion. And it hit me right between the eyes, you know. And I absolutely believe that he's right, and it absolutely just changed the way I started to think about things entirely and retreat, I'm happy to say, from any kind of conservatism in the usual regard, because that is the first responsibility of government.
Whether I'd say it's the first responsibility of humanity. I'd actually go further than government.
Yes, it is.
I agree.
And, you know, but that's not what we hear today. It's not what we talk about. It occurs to me, you know, even in terms of the stress in the Middle East or the political stress, where do you have anybody in this country anymore even talking about the idea of peace?
And the idea of empathy.
You don't hear it.
The idea not just of sympathy, which is good. Sympathy is better than nothing. But empathy, really recognizing that there, but for the grace of God, go I.
And we've put into a pattern here, which I think is equally tragic. We don't have community. Some tragedy happens. So we all throw money at it, which is nice in a way. So we give
and flowers and stuffed animals.
Or whatever disaster happens. But we don't really care. We don't have to care. We just throw a $10 bill at it. And that's true.
Well, I think right now we're at a very critical period. I think that the discussion that we're having, you know, the community versus individualism, I think to some extent, politically and socially, that discussion is playing itself out in politics. I think that the compassion and communitarian spirit is represented with the ACA, and I think the knuckle draggers, as I call them, in the Republican Party are fighting their last great fight against communitarian values, because I think the ACA represents compassion. It represents unity. Well, it's now, God knows it's not perfect, but it represents a different spirit that says exactly what Kerry's saying. Because we've got people saying the government's bad, the government's terrible, the government shouldn't be. You know, the government's not perfect, but part of the a big part of the responsibility of the government is the general welfare of the people, to make sure there's a level playing field, to make sure that everybody to get prosperity, not wealth. And I think that we're at the big fight, and I think the fight is already won. And those across the individualists are, they're not going to go down. They're going to go down swinging.
Here's what I find so ironic: if you listen to the rhetoric of the right wing, and they've gotten pretty good at their rhetoric. I'm thinking about the things that they talk about. What do they talk about? They talk about family. They talk about church. They talk about nation. Now, what is family, church, and nation? These are all communities. And what makes us support family and faith communities? Community, I even use the word communities right there. And our nation is this idea that we're all in this together. You know, I am here with my family. I'm here with my friends. I'm here with my religious community. I'm here with my nation or my town or what, you know, we're members of all kinds of communities. And so they use this communitarian language at the same time as they push policies that literally tear us apart.
They are not really speaking the same language, unfortunately, because what they are talking about is tribalism, and it's not the same thing as community. The more frightened we get, the more anxious we get, the more fear that is imposed upon us, we retreat. We retreat to our tribe. And I have first, believe me, I have family in Texas, and this is where I really observe this the most, is they become extremely tribal. So yes, they have their community. Yes, they value their family. Yes, they value their tribe, but don't you get close to their border, because they'll kill you on the spot. It's a totally different philosophy than what we're talking about.
So what you're saying is that family becomes excluding other families,
yes.
Church becomes excluding other churches,
right.
And nation becomes excluding other nations.
Yeah, and it's based on fear. They don't even recognize that's what it's based on. It's not based on thought or compassion or Christianity. It's based on fear.
Yeah, and their tribe is a very, very small, pure tribe. And as you can see now, it's getting even smaller and more pure. And you're either, see, they have a very black and white way of looking at things, a very good and bad. You're either with us or you're our enemy. And so it's intolerant, angry. It can be, racist, homophobic, and name all of the above. Basically, when you see racism or homophobia or all those other things, it's exactly what Kerry's saying. You're not part of my tribe. You're not part of my group. So I don't want anything to do with you. And whatever it is, whatever particular thing it is about you that we don't approve of, that means you're not part of my tribe, which means either you're with us or you're the enemy.
They
don't see any other option. And they certainly don't want any of their money or any of their tax dollars going to help the enemy.
See, and that comes back around full circle to what I was saying about empathy, that it's all about imagining yourself in the position of that person. And, it's hard to do, right? I mean, you pass a homeless person on the street and they want a dollar. And it's you think, well, I could give them a dollar, but there's hundreds of thousands of homeless people, and I guess I give all of them a dollar, but then I need my, it's hard because society isn't taking care of these people, and it's hard because you almost have to divide yourself because the problem is so overwhelming that it's very hard to individually help. I will though tell you a story. That a friend of mine told me recently, which I thought was a great story. He said a guy came upon a man, and he was throwing starfish in the ocean. Now, starfish, apparently, if they get washed up on shore, if they don't get back to the ocean within 24 hours or so, they die. And there were hundreds of thousands of starfish sitting on the shore, and this guy watched this guy throwing starfish in, and he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm throwing starfish in the ocean." He said, you're not even going to make an impact. There's 100,000, there's a big wave, and there's thousands of starfish, and how many are you going to throw back in? It won't make a difference. It doesn't matter." And as the guy picks up a starfish and throws it in the ocean, he says, "Well, it mattered to this one." It mattered to this one.
Yeah. When I was living in Manhattan, like I say, it was during the height of the crap epidemic, and the theater that I had was down on 42nd Street. And I was walking there on Mother's Day to go do some business at the theater and passing the Port Authority, the port terminal right there on 42nd. And, you know, at that time during the crack epidemic, the place was a real mess. And I'm walking by, and there's a doorway there, and in that doorway is this woman, you know, cuddled up, homeless person, you know, vomit all over the place and everything else. And I was so stricken by her, that she wasn't awake. I just stood there and looked at her, and I realized, you know, without any doubt, this is not what she chose.
Clearly.
Not what her parents chose. This is not something right. that just she did. This is so big and so complex. And so I did the pathetic thing, you know, I left a $5 bill with her, you know, or something like that. But I decided at that point, I never question or judge any homeless person anymore. If they ask me for money and if I can get it out of my pocket, I will give it to them. I don't care what their situation is. I don't care how they're using it. Can you even imagine the indignity of having to beg?
Yeah.
You know, how can we turn people down?
Well, let me tell you, I was a police officer, and I tell you right now, you go in any prison, and you start asking the prisoners, one by one, tell me about your life. Over and over and over, you will hear the most tragic stories you could ever imagine. You'll look and say, look at this guy, he's a thief, he's a licensed criminal, blah, blah, blah. Tell me about your life. Well, my parents were both heroin addicts. And they beat me every day. I mean, those, you know, and when you hear the stories of the prisoners and you think to yourself, well, these people, you know, they murdered somebody. They did, these are horrible things. When you hear the stories of them, you realize to a large extent they're victims. You know, if our society would address some of these ills, a lot of these things could be prevented. Some of them are a lot of them are very intelligent people. They're not stupid, but they have lived a life of tragedy. And instead of looking at everyone exactly as Terry said, every homeless person, every person in prison as, oh, these are bad people getting what they deserve, you know, but for the grace of God, go I. If you or I had grew, or any of the three of us had grown up and both of our parents were heroin addicts and everything else and they beat us and prostituted us and everything else, God knows we sure wouldn't be doing the Ruckus Caucus right now.
The United States.
Even Mitt Romney would wind up on the gutter.
You know, Mitt Romney's dad was on welfare for a while. People never talk about that. Listen, the United States of America has the highest incarceration rate in the world. It used to be that South Africa and the Soviet Union were the two higher. We were third. Well, guess what? We have risen now to being, we're number one, folks. We have the highest, and that's the rate. That's not the numbers, not the pure numbers. That's the rate. That's percentage of people in jail. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world. And I was struck by what Garland said because I don't think that Americans are more criminally minded than anyone else in the world. I don't think that we're bad people any more than Canadians or Dutch or French or Italians or Japanese or Haitians or anybody. I think the answer is we have so many social ills and so little helping us get out of that people turn to criminality. And we also, of course, have people in prisons for drug crimes and silly things like that. But if we were to help people, we would not only save a ton of money because, you know, it costs money to incarcerate people, but we could save lives. We'd make America more productive. People would go about and live better lives. And it seems to me that the cost is so much more minimal to save a life than to basically destroy a life and have that person kill someone else and then incarcerate them. It's just, it's crazy that we even think that way.
Instead, we're cutting Head Start.
Right.
We're cutting money from Head Start. The bottom line is this. It's so short-sighted. You know, when you give kids a little bit more of a start, they have a better chance of not ending up in prison. The probability that they'll go down the wrong road decreases. We're spending a little bit money now on these Head Starts and these other programs. It's going to save us a lot in the long run as a society. It's going to save us money. It's going to save us lives. But we're so boneheaded and stupid that we cut, of all things, Head Start.
Yeah, and I was going to say also women and infants with children. That's the program that basically feeds starving kids in America. Guess what? That's a part of the government shutdown. The Republicans want to make sure our monuments are open, I guess, because people get mad. But, you know, starving kids don't write in their congressmen very much. They'll let the kids starve to make sure the monuments are open.
And, you know, I guess the part of the real flaw is, you know, we do see people that supposedly take advantage of the system or take advantage of, you know, welfare or Medicare or whatever. I mean, so what? You know, I mean, considering the options, considering the choices, why would I even bother to be concerned because somebody twists the system a little bit to get their few food stamps as opposed to the corporations which own the system and twist it any way they want to make sure that the 1% never have to even think about the rest of the population?
I've always wondered that, Terry.
Or not.
I've always wondered why a conservative gets so angry. He got double his allotment of food stamps. He got $8 a day instead of $4 a day. He's committing fraud. Throw that bum in prison. And by the way, we're going to pay $10,000 a year to put that guy in prison. But the Wall Street guy who stole hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, well, that's how it's done on Wall Street, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
Garland, you had one last word to say?
Yeah.
It's a great show. I mean, I think we pretty much covered it, and we've come up with all the ideas that needed to be, the things that could be done to fix the country.
Yeah, but we never figured out the cause of our own personal insanity as to why we come together and insult each other every week. But that
because
remains a mystery.
Let's face it.
What's that, Terry?
Because we love each other.
Because we love each other, and that's what you do when you love each other. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Garland. Terry, if they want to find you, where would they go?
Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com.
Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com. Garland?
At Garland Nixon on Twitter, GarlandN at gmail.com email, and just Garland Nixon Facebook.
And I am Mark Levine, and you can find me on my website, marklevinetalk.com. Follow me on Twitter at marklevinetalk. I am also on Facebook, facebook.com/marklevinetalk. Thank you, Garland. Thank you, Terry. We are here every week. We are the Raucous Caucus at noon on Sundays on WEAC Radio, AM 1480. If you miss any aspect of the show, it will be on my website at marklevinetalk.com in a few hours. I got to get some time to put it up. Again, thank you, Terry. Thank you, Garland. Coming up
thank
next
you,
is the Inside Scoop. I want to talk at length about the government shutdown and actually debate a conservative on it, a Republican political strategist. You won't want to miss that. Coming up on the Inside Scoop right after this.